This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Friday, September 25th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Ruth Bader Ginsburg contributed powerful opinions on any number of high-profile cases in her decades on the Supreme Court. After her scathing dissent in Bush v. Gore in 2000, Ginsburg gave a speech in which she described the case as an example of how important and difficult it is for judges to do what is legally right, no matter what the home crowd wants. But Ginsburg was an icon even before her time on the court. She made her reputation as a young lawyer by arguing more than 300 gender discrimination cases, six of them before the court. On the court, she was famously friendly with her ideological opposite, Antonin Scalia, who once bought her a dozen roses for her birthday because, he said, he believed that some things are more important than votes. During a memorial service in the Supreme Court's Great Hall on Wednesday, Chief Justice John Roberts eulogized Ginsburg.
Subjected to discrimination in law school and the job market because she was a woman, Ruth would grow to become the leading advocate fighting such discrimination in court. She was not an opera star, but she found her stage right behind me in our courtroom. There, she won famous victories that helped move our nation closer to equal justice under law, to the extent that women are now a majority in law schools, not simply a handful. Later, she became a star on the bench, where she sat for 27 years. Her 483 majority, concurring, and dissenting opinions will steer the court for decades.
On Saturday, Trump will announce his nominee for her seat, a major victory in his and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's crusade to fill the federal courts with conservative judges. His choice will almost certainly be confirmed by the Senate, and they promise to get it done by Election Day. New Yorker staff writers Jane Mayer and Jeffrey Toobin join me to discuss what a 6-3 conservative ratio on the Supreme Court would mean for key upcoming cases for the Democratic Party as the election approaches and for the foreseeable future of the country. Jane and Jeff, always great to have you on.
Great to be with you.
Hi, Dorothy.
All right, Jeff, we're going to start with you. Ginsburg's influence on the law and on popular culture have been immense. Maybe just give us a little brief about her impact.
Well, you know, the paradox of Ruth Ginsburg's influence on the law is that it was greater as a lawyer than as a justice. That, you know, she was the pioneer of women's rights cases before the Supreme Court. She won a series of them and contributed to briefs in more, which really created the modern legal relationship of women in the law. I mean, the when she started litigating cases, women couldn't get credit cards without their husband's signature. There were men's classified advertisements in newspapers. Younger listeners might want to ask their parents what a newspaper is. But, all of that, you know, is gone. And that's because of the cases that she and other feminist lawyers of her generation brought. In her 27 years on the court, she was mostly in dissent on the big cases. She lost more often than she won, and she was a woman sort of like her parallel figure Thurgood Marshall, who was not as influential as a justice as he was as a lawyer. And that trend, of course, will only accelerate with her replacement.
It seems to many of us that her legacy is now threatened. And I keep asking myself whether she made a terrible mistake by not retiring during Obama's second term.
Terrible mistake. Terrible mistake. And it wasn't like, you know, no one thought of it at the time. She was already in her 80s. She had already had cancer several times. It is, at least in my humble opinion, a stain on her legacy that she didn't leave when she did. I think you could write a whole book about all the acts that were made on the assumption that Hillary Clinton was going to win anyway.
Yes.
So what difference did it make if she left when Obama was president. But like many of us, she bet wrong on that outcome. And by the slimmest of margins, she did not outlast Donald Trump. And I think the consequences will be enormous for the causes she believes in.
Jane, I assume you agree with that.
I do. I mean, I have read that what she was thinking supposedly was that, of course, Hillary Clinton would be elected and she wanted to have her replacement nominated by a female president. That was the sort of one of the arguments that she was making. And Tubin's right. So many people made the same miscalculation. It's incredible. And I imagine she would have probably stepped down given her health situation. Though, as I understand it, she was clear-headed and still doing, you know, more than her full workload almost right down till the very end. So she, you know, she felt she was the best woman for the job almost till the very end. And
well, she was, but Mitch McConnell was hard at work, you know, at that point.
He was talking to big donors in behind closed doors and saying, as he, you know, sort of delicately put it, when Ruth Bader Ginsburg meets her reward, we're going to be all set with our October surprise. And he, you know, they were dangling it juicily in front of big donors. He wasn't going to wait. And I think she knew he wasn't going to wait.
You know, the reason why McConnell can rally those big donors is not because they are particularly obsessed with making abortion illegal. It's the other aspects of the conservative agenda. It's the limitations on regulation that Kavanaugh, that Gorsuch, that, you know, Amy Barrett or whoever it turns out to be will likely embrace. It is the interests of campaign contributors. It's expansion of Citizens United, which has been a particular obsession of McConnell's. That's really why McConnell has been so obsessed with the Supreme Court, is that he has a substantive agenda for his campaign contributors that only the Supreme Court can deliver.
You are so absolutely right, I think. And that's such a good point to make because people forget it. But Mitch McConnell, if you talk to people who've known him throughout his career, he doesn't really care about abortion one way or the other. What he cares about is money in politics and, in fact, getting more money into politics and serving the big financial and economic interests in the country. And this court, with one more conservative justice, stands to sort of undo everything back to before the New Deal era. All of the kinds of curbs that were placed on businesses of in the FDR's era and later, you know, environmental laws and all kinds of, you know, workplace regulations. That's where the money is.
And he has been so successful, you know, at every level in installing conservative judges. So actually, both of you have written about this, but maybe, Jane, you start, you know, just explain how he's done it.
Well, he's single-minded, and he shares a strength with President Trump, which is neither of them are susceptible to being shamed. People who accuse them of hypocrisy, that it just doesn't matter to them particularly. And that to some extent that rules are for chumps. He's very smart, people say that he is excellent in seeing, you know, chess moves, several moves out. And, you know, he's just been very single-minded in doing this.
And then there's the Federalist Society. Jeff, maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, again, money plays a role here that the Federalist Society, which is lavishly funded for what started as a student organization, has been a farm team and a sort of long-term talent show where starting as law students, conservatives have cultivated very intelligent, and I think it's really important to point out that a lot of these top conservatives are really smart and really qualified in all these formal terms. And they have been, I don't want to use the term indoctrinated because it suggests that they are being told things that they don't believe in the first place, but, you know, they have been cultivated, I guess is a better word, with an agenda that is very much like Mitch McConnell's. And it is not, as Jane pointed out, I mean, it is not, you know, necessarily focused on the social issues like, you know, LGBT rights and, of course, abortion, although that's part of it. It is really about attacking the regulatory state.
I mean, if I can just inject a tiny bit of history, go back to 1971, and Lewis Powell, before he was on the Supreme Court, wrote a famous memo. Business was really upset in 1971. They saw the rise of sort of the environmental movement, the anti-war movement.
The consumer movement, Ralph Nader. The
movement with Ralph Nader. So they hired Lewis Powell to take a look at it and try to help organize the business power. And what Powell did, if you look back at that memo, is he said, you know what? The opponents of big business, they're not the kids in the street who are demonstrating. It's the establishment. And we need to take over the establishment. And specifically, he said, we need to take over the courts. And they set about it very methodically. So back when, you know, I was covering Reagan's presidency, you had Ed Meese as attorney general. They were stocking the courts and they were cultivating people through this Federalist Society, which was funded by big business donors, people like the Kochs. And they've really, you know, sort of cultivated and nurtured a movement. And for some reason, really, the Democrats have never really played it back at them in the same way.
But could you just explain that a little bit? Because it is somewhat mystifying. I mean, there they were. They saw what was unfolding before them.
This has been a huge obsession of mine. And one of the, you know, and I interviewed Barack Obama while he was president. And I asked him about judges. And, you know, his passivity on the issue was really quite startling. He was very concerned about diversity on the bench. You know, it was important to him, as it is, and it was important. But the idea that the courts were a vehicle for political change was something that he both said to me and he'd written was something that was uncomfortable for him. He thinks, you know, change comes from politics, from voting. Hmm. Now, it may be that if Biden wins and the Democrats retake the Senate, it's been such a conspicuous strategy on the right that they can't help but respond in kind. But we'll see. I'm not sure. As Jane said, it has just not been something that Democrats have mobilized around.
Well, Democrats tend to think of justice as an issue that's above partisanship. They've tried to adhere to that. But I really think, and there's a very interesting piece that was written by Ezra Klein recently, last day or two, that suggests that McConnell, in his radical hardball approach to the courts, is now going to radicalize the Democrats, because they sort of face a choice of either conceding and being run over or fighting back. So you're going to have sort of reluctant moderates like Biden facing the big issue, if he wins and if the Democrats take the Senate, of whether or not to so-called pack the court, expand the court.
Well, but Jeff, let's talk about packing the court. Ginsburg actually told NPR last year, you know, if anything would make the court look partisan, it would be that. She was totally opposed to that idea.
Tough. You know, how long do Democrats have to be patsies until they fight back? I mean, a lot of people don't know that the number of Supreme Court justices is not specified in the Constitution. And in the early days of the Republic, the number changed a lot over the years. And it was only in 1869 that the number settled at 9, and it has been at 9 ever since, notwithstanding Franklin Roosevelt's attempt to pack the court in 1937 after the court struck down many of his New Deal measures. It's not necessarily the first step Democrats should take. I mean, certainly they need to abolish the filibuster, which is, as Barack Obama said, a Jim Crow relic that needs to go. Joe Biden, if he's fortunate enough to win, and if the Democrats are fortunate enough to retake the Senate, as well as hold the House, you know, he's going to be faced with the prospect of accomplishing nothing, and thus being presented as a do-nothing president unless he gets rid of the filibuster. And, you know, that's a choice that I think he'd be fortunate to have to make, but I think he's going to have to make it, because McConnell, as he said of Barack Obama, my top priority is to make him a one-term president. It will be his priority with Biden as well. And the way he can do that is through the use of the filibuster.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
A key question is what the chances are that the Senate could go Democratic. What is your view of that? There are senators who look vulnerable, Susan Collins of Maine and Martha McSally of Arizona among them, and even Lindsey Graham seems to be facing a strong challenge in South Carolina.
The map is tough for the Republicans. It's the opposite of what it was during the last Senate elections. I'm not a forecaster. I only read what the forecasters say. But if you look at something like the Cook Political Report, there's a very good chance that the Democrats could take the majority. It's really hard to predict right now. But one of the things that I've been interested in is how the Ginsburg fight might affect that. That fight, the idea of filling Ginsburg's seat, is going to energize the base on both sides. And what I'm told is that in many ways, it's the base on the Democratic side that needed more juicing, so it helps the Democrats more. It may galvanize young voters who were holding their nose about Biden and saying, you know, what's the difference? Who cares? Now they understand that a Roe v. Wade could be overturned. They may not be able to have access to health care that covers pre-existing conditions and puts them on their parents' plans until they're 26. And it also isn't, you know, I mean, face it, reproductive rights are an issue that is very much on the mind of female voters. And women may decide this election because women are so much less positive about Trump.
So I want to look ahead at these incredibly important cases coming up, especially the Affordable Care Act, which was Obama's signature legislation and is going to almost immediately be facing a challenge in the Supreme Court, I think the week after the election. Tell us what's at stake there.
Well, the title of this case, I think, tells you everything you need to know. The title of the Obamacare case is California v. Texas. It's about red versus blue in America. And the case is somewhat complicated in terms of the various outcomes that could come from it. One outcome is that Obamacare is struck down in its entirety. I mean, that is a realistic possibility, and it is the possibility that the Trump administration's Justice Department is urging on the Supreme Court. There are other options that essentially allow the court to kick the can down the road or to strike down just part of Obamacare. There are a lot of moving parts, but with Ginsburg on the court, plus John Roberts, who was twice voted to uphold Obamacare, the risk to the law was considerably less than it is now, where Roberts, who was very much the swing vote last term, could find himself being irrelevant with, you know, Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Sam Alito, plus the new Trump justice. That is a particularly chilling thought if Brett Kavanaugh suddenly becomes the middle of the court, because he's not in the middle of anything.
Yeah, I feel like it, to some extent, the conservative movement may be in danger of being the dog that caught the bus. They may be able to finally get what they say they want, overturn the Affordable Health Care Act, overturn Roe v. Wade. Both of those pieces of legislation, those laws, are popular with the American public in a big way. These issues may be more useful in campaigning as the opposition than actually being a ruling majority on them.
And yet, touching on something that you both were talking about earlier, about the hardball politics of of Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump, Joe Biden's politics of empathy don't really feel like they're any match for those of the Trumpists. You know, we have seen House Speaker Pelosi, she can be tough, but they espouse these old-fashioned Democratic ideas about cooperation, moderation, following the rule of law, all very honorable. But McConnell and his allies play dirty, and it's worked for them. And as we go into the final weeks of the election, Democrats live in terror that Trump is far more visible still than Joe Biden. And Joe Biden comes out in his mask and he's mocked and he looks to many people weaker than Trump.
Oh, come on, Dorothy.
I mean,
you know, are we going to simply ignore the fact that Biden's ahead in all the polls? I mean, Democrats have a well-earned talent for panic and pessimism and
yes,
you know,
do.
Doomsaying. But I mean, my God, there was a Fox News poll yesterday that had him up 5 points in Ohio.
What about Florida?
Florida's
and Pennsylvania.
Close. And Pennsylvania's ahead 10 points. I mean, you know, it's just, you know, the idea that the Biden campaign is some kind of terrible disaster. I mean, look at the polls. What else do we have to go on?
What do you think, Jane?
I actually am relatively optimistic as Tubin is because of the looking at the polls. Public opinion looks exhausted with Trump and with the chaos. And a lot of it, we haven't even discussed COVID-19, but this pandemic, it's so clearly an example of what happens when the government is badly run. A lot of Trump's support has been in older voters before, and he's losing a lot of support there because he's trying to tell people that this is not really all that serious and it's going to go away on its own. And instead, what's going away are people's relatives forever. And just to go back to the issue that we've begun on, which is the issue of how does this court vacancy play politically. One advantage for Trump is it does change the subject from the pandemic to his court fight. And, you know, he's a master of distraction. And surely he will, you know, present his nominee in some sort of crowning moment at the White House that's, you know, gets tons of media coverage and try to keep the attention on all of this.
To be continued. Thanks so much, both of you.
Great to be with you.
Bye.
Jane Mayer is The New Yorker's chief Washington correspondent. Her books include Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right, and Strange Justice, The Selling of Clarence Thomas. Jeffrey Toobin's books include True Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Investigation of Donald Trump, and The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.